I'm so excited for you guys to listen to this week's episode of the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant podcast.
The universe has an amazing way of handing us exactly what we need. So I go down to this mother goddess sacred river that I just thought was a beautiful body of water and look out over the river and have this sudden, spontaneous spiritual experience of being in the presence of the divine. And just suddenly, I was acutely aware on every way of knowing that I had my eyes, my ears, my smell, I mean, all of my senses, but also my intellect, my understanding. Everything suddenly was just swimming in presence of the divine. Watch me steal the show. Higher ground, yeah, I'm rising fast. This is my moment, it's built to last. Keep the focus, keep the drive. No slow motion, I'm alive. Power surging, can't deny. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant Show. I'm your host, Rebecca Whitman. We're taking you from burned out to balanced, beautiful, and abundant. Today, we have a very special guest in the studio. Her name is Sadhvi G, and she is a world-renowned spiritual teacher coming live to us from India. Welcome to the show, Sadhvi G. So wonderful to be with you and to be together with your whole community.
Oh, I'm so glad you're here. And let me tell my community a little bit about your very interesting background. Sadhvi G is a world-renowned spiritual leader, author, and teacher based in Rishikesh. Rishikesh, India. She is a Stanford graduate, originally from Los Angeles, and she left behind Western society and culture for a higher calling. For 25 years, she's lived in an ashram. She leads humanitarian initiatives, empowers women and children, bringing them clean water and sanitation to communities around the world. And she has been recognized at the United Nations, the Parliament of World Religions. She received a Presidential Medal of Honor. She works closely with world leaders on issues of peace and sustainability. She is also a best-selling author of the book From Hollywood to the Himalayas. So Sadhvi G, after growing up in Los Angeles and graduating from Stanford, you had a spiritual awakening on the banks of the Ganga River. Tell us about that moment. What was that like?
So, you know, it's now been almost 30 years that I've been here. And no matter how many days, months, years it is, telling about the experience doesn't get easier until and unless the English language starts inventing a whole bunch of new words. I feel like I'm going to be stuck with the difficulty of describing this forever. It was an experience of really coming home. Yeah. Of coming home to the truth of who I am, coming home to myself, coming home to the divine. As you mentioned, I came to India on what I thought was just a really short vacation, a trip, an adventure in the middle of my PhD program. I, after graduating undergrad at Stanford, was in the midst of getting a PhD in pediatric neuropsychology. And I wasn't a spiritual person. I wasn't someone who identified as spiritual, I should say. We're all spiritual beings. But I was not someone who identified as that. I identified as a scientist, as an academic, as, you know, someone who looked the way that I looked and wore the clothes that I wore. And that was the way that I was raised. It's the way that so much of our culture is. And in addition to having all of the privilege and the prosperity and the opportunity and the blessings of the life that I grew up in Los Angeles, quite literally in Hollywood, hence the Hollywood to the Himalayas title of my memoir. In spite of all of that, there was an emptiness inside, an experience of not being connected, of not being full, an experience of lack. It's like no matter how much you have, but there's an emptiness inside that no amount of clothing or parties or straight A's or money or food or relationships can fill. And I came to India on an adventure break with a backpack, and I didn't know anything about India. The only reason that I agreed to come was I was a very, very strict vegetarian, still am, but I had become a very strict vegetarian in my teenage years. And I knew that in India, I could actually eat happily. And it was the only reason, as embarrassing as it is to admit, almost 30 years, excuse me.
No problem.
Almost 30 years later, as embarrassing as that is to admit, I came because I knew that I could eat happily and that I wasn't going to have fights with waiters in languages that I didn't speak about whether there's chicken broth in something or eggs in something or fish in something. And I came. And this was 1996, so it was pre-Google, pre-being able to just go online and say where to go in India. And
right.
So we had a very thick Lonely Planet guidebook. And I opened the guidebook sitting over a cup of coffee in Delhi and said, Rishikesh. It sounded beautiful. I've always been a nature person. It was a land of mountains and of a river. And I didn't know, you know, you mentioned the banks of the Ganga, which is the Hindi way of saying the Ganges River.
Mm.
And I didn't know that this river is sacred. I didn't know that this river is the mother goddess. I just knew a river, the Ganges River. I didn't know that the Himalayas were sacred. I just knew mountains. But when you arrive in New Delhi and you open up a 500-page guidebook, Rishikesh seemed like a perfect place. You know, people say to me, how did you come to Rishikesh, expecting that it was like, you know, a sort of divine infusion straight into my mind? And actually, it was literally just the first page that came when I opened this guidebook. And it was perfect. It wasn't too far from Delhi. It was naturally beautiful. Lots of yoga. I was already a yoga student, but again, not from a spiritual perspective, from the perspective of being a student who pre-mobile and pre-iPad days was lugging around bags full of books and notebooks and, you know, achy shoulders and achy neck. And I learned yoga as a way to deal with the pain in the shoulders and the pain in the neck and the stress and depression and anxiety and dis-ease in my mind. But I mention it because Rishikesh is the world capital of yoga. And what? So when you have a city that is close to Delhi where you are, beautiful mountains, beautiful river, world capital of yoga, it just seemed like a perfect place to go. And so we came here, and I came down to the Ganges with simply the idea that I was going to stick my feet in this river, cool down, freshen up. I was hot, I was tired. And this is why it's a story of grace. And this is why, for me, it's been such a powerful learning and teaching experience, because that which we don't even know we're looking for can arrive in our life. It's not like we have to micromanage everything. It's not that we have to pre-script everything.
Yeah.
If we are open, willing, in heart, in mind, in life, the universe has an amazing way of handing us exactly what we need. So I go down to this mother goddess sacred river that I just thought was a beautiful body of water and look out over the river and have this sudden, spontaneous spiritual experience of being in the presence of the divine. And just suddenly, I was acutely aware on every way of knowing that I had my eyes, my ears, my smell, I mean, all of my senses, but also my intellect, my understanding. Everything suddenly was just swimming in presence of the divine. It was like no matter what I looked at, I was seeing the divine in everything. And it knocked me to the ground, quite literally. And at some point in this experience, I turned that sight inward and I realized, oh my God, I am also divine. And as obvious and trite as it sounds today, 30 years later, it was a huge thing for me. It had never occurred to me. I was 25 at the time. And the idea that I was anything other than broken, damaged, not quite right, despite the external seeming perfection. I mean, if you had seen me from the outside, you would have said, oh, this girl's got everything. So despite the seeming perfection from the outside, my internal felt sense experience was one of lack.
Mm-hmm.
Not smart enough, not beautiful enough, not good enough, not pure enough, not worthy enough, not valuable enough, not right at the very core. And I think it's something that even though all of our, you know, traumas or struggles have their own unique origin story, I think that a lot of us have this inside of us of there is something fundamentally not right about who I am.
Now, do you think that is a personal feeling of not enoughness, or do you think that's prevalent in the Western culture? Because so many of the people who listen to this show, men and women, have this limiting belief of I am not enough. Exactly. So where does that come from? I mean, is that the ego? Is that the culture? Is that childhood trauma, in your opinion? Where is that coming from that so many people have it? And do they have it in India?
Great, great question. So I've actually thought a lot about this over the years. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you a couple of fun stories since you mentioned that this is something that is very up for your community. Mm-hmm. Not surprisingly, because as I said, I think it's something that is up for a huge percentage, an overwhelmingly majority percentage of people in the West. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly prevalent / epidemic amongst everyone I know. And it was my way of living. And I think that it is a mix of the culture that we live in and the personal experiences that we all have, which, although they are different, have the same core elements. So I think, for example, one of the aspects is that most of us grow up in homes with parents who are trying to inspire us, discipline us, push us. And they use ways of inspiring us that actually end up damaging us. So for example, when parents say things like, oh, your room is all cleaned up, you are such a good girl, or you're such a good boy. Or we come home with a good report card and our parents give us huge hugs and kisses and love, and then they take us out for ice cream or cookies and they just shower us with praise.
Mm-hmm.
And when we come home with not good report cards, if we're fortunate enough to not be actually abused physically or emotionally, we certainly are not being given hugs and kisses and praise and love. And so I think that pretty pervasively, we grow up with this idea that my worthiness of love is based on what I do. And I have to perform constantly in order to continue to be worthy of that love. And I think that's something that a lot of us carry with us. I think that there are certain aspects in the Judeo-Christian religious traditions, in the cultural manifestations of that, that lead to inner feelings of sin, of darkness, of wrongness, of needing to be saved. And again, it's what I do. If I do enough of this or that, or I, you know, stop myself from doing that very natural urge, well, then I will be worthy of being saved. Then I will be okay.
We're going to pause it right here for a quick commercial break. When we come back, I want to talk about Indian culture is very focused on intelligence, doctor, lawyer. The parents put a lot of pressure on their kids to be achievers. So I am wondering, when we come back from this break, is that part of the Indian culture also in the cycle of egoic gratification and not good enough and having to achieve, achieve, achieve? So that's what I want to explore when we come back. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening to the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant show. We're so glad you're here, and we'll be right back after this very quick break. I am so excited. I created something special just for you. It's called the Balanced, Beautiful Bundle. And inside this bundle, you're going to get instant access to a PDF copy of my best-selling book, How to Make a Six-Figure Income Working Part-Time. You're going to get my best health and beauty tips to help you glow from the inside out. You'll get my Elegant Warrior Manifesto, a daily reminder of your power, grace, and purpose. You'll get my Abundance Journal to help you manifest more joy, love, and prosperity. And you'll get a daily journal reminder to keep your mindset strong and your energy and your vibe high every single day. This bundle is your shortcut to balance, beauty, and abundance in an elegant way. So grab your copy now by going to the show notes and start living your most balanced, beautiful, abundant life today. Hey there, it's Rebecca, your magnetic abundance mentor. Let me ask you something. Are you feeling stuck, burned out, or like life just isn't as juicy as you know it can be? If you're nodding right along, it's time for a breakthrough. My coaching program is designed to help you align your life in all seven pillars of abundance: spiritual, physical, emotional, romantic, mental, social, and financial. So you can finally live that big, bold, sexy, and adventurous life you deserve. And here's the best part. I'm inviting you to schedule a breakthrough call with me. No pressure, no sales gimmicks, just a genuine chance to experience my coaching firsthand and get crystal clear on what is next for you. Because your best life is not a someday thing, it's a right now thing. So click the link in the show notes to book your breakthrough call and let's start making magic together. Your next level is calling you. This podcast review is from Bring It On, and she says that the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant show is amazing and inspiring. She goes on to say, I believe this show is a place where women can come and really learn and grow. Rebecca creates a strong and safe space for women to share and be vulnerable. I highly recommend this podcast. Thank you so much. And it is absolutely a safe place for all women to come and learn. Thanks for being a great listener. Welcome back to the Balanced, Beautiful, and Abundant podcast. So we're here with spiritual teacher, world-renowned thought leader from India, Sadhviji. We're so happy she's here. She is from LA, and she's comparing the achievement ethos of American culture to Indian culture. Is there a difference in how they achieve?
Well, let me go back for a moment.
Sure.
I think it's actually somewhat deeper and more subtle than simply achievement.
Mm.
I think it has to do with, in general, performance.
Okay.
And it's where we end up with cultures of people pleasers. It's where we end up with a sense of the core of who I am is not worthy of love. It is not worthy of occupying my place on planet Earth. And in order to be worthy, I have to do something to prove that I am worthy. And certainly in many cases, that is achievement. But I don't think it's only achievement. I think sometimes it simply has to do with anticipating somebody else's needs, of doing whatever, you know, you think that somebody is going to want. It's going to be about a constant sense of, if I stop doing, I'm not worthy. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, as I was saying, for me, certainly something that I struggled with a lot. I think also, though, going back for a moment, that it's cultural, but I also think that for a lot of us, we've had very deep personal, mm-hmm. emotional, psychological trauma that has led us to feel like there is something wrong with us. When parents or others are abusive in some way, the message that we get is that we deserve it. When mm. they are distant, absent in some way, either physically or just emotionally, there's a sense that we are not worthy of attention, not worthy of love, that we are the ones who have to change in some way. When you have a culture that has got such a prevalence around divorce, mm-hmm. one of the things that we know about kids and magical thinking is that a lot of kids feel like, if I were just better, mom and dad wouldn't fight so much, and then mom and dad wouldn't get divorced. And of course, you know, good therapy at the right time, or very emotionally intelligent and mature parents, can certainly offset that. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's far too many places in which we don't get that. So we do, I think, end up really with a culture in which so many of us have this inner feeling of not rightness and not enoughness. And you know, one of my favorite stories about this is a story that Jack Kornfield tells. He was a very famous Buddhist meditation teacher and a dear friend of mine, of sitting with His Holiness the Dalai Lama in a very small group of American Buddhist leaders, in which one of them asked His Holiness about how to help people through self-hatred. And it took His Holiness's translator 10 full minutes to even semantically explain to His Holiness what the words self and hatred
meant. My gosh. Wow. That's telling.
But just semantically, he couldn't wrap his brain around it. And then he looks at this group and thinking he's been asked the most obscure question, he says, well, how frequently do you encounter this self-hatred thing? And they all were like, all the time, every day. And he then looked at them and he said, well, have any of you ever experienced this self-hatred thing? And they all went, you know.
So yeah.
What I've seen from stories of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, as told by Jack, of my guru, of other American Buddhist Hindu teachers speaking about their guru meeting their Western students, is there is a huge difference, interestingly, around the core sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
In the West versus here. It's not that India doesn't have its own set of problems. Of course it does. And yet, on a mental health level, that sense of core lack of value, lack of worth, lack of deserving to occupy your place on planet Earth or being undeserving of love, is much, much, much less prevalent. It's getting more as things are westernizing, as there's more, you know,
they're catching our neurosis.
Yeah. And as you alluded to, you know, pressure around achievement, but in general, it's much, much, much psychologically healthier here from what I've seen over these last 30 years. But going back to the story, so I had this incredible experience of suddenly realizing, oh my God, I'm not damaged, unworthy, not enough, lacking in some fundamental way, but I am divine. I am one with that same divinity that pervades everything that I'm looking at. And it was a moment that transformed my life. And it was from that I knew that I was meant to be here. And so that was, yeah, I've just celebrated my 29th anniversary with Rishikesh, with the Ganges, with Ma Ganga.
Okay. Can I be real for a second? You're out there crushing it in some areas of your life, but in others, it's like a hot mess express. Sound familiar? Here's the thing. You're not just meant to survive, you're meant to thrive. And that's exactly what I help my clients do in my coaching program. Together, we'll tackle all 7 pillars of abundance, because who wants killer abs but a dumpster fire of a bank account? Or a thriving career, but zero in the romance department? Yeah, no thanks. I'm inviting you to schedule a breakthrough call with me. No pressure, no awkward sales pitch, just you, me, and a chance to figure out why you're stuck and how to get unstuck. So stop doom scrolling and start doing something about it. Click the link in the show notes and let's start giving you your best, most bougie life. You in? This one says gaining clarity, and it's from Kate House. Listening to and learning from Rebecca has helped me gain clarity on what matters most to me, and it has inspired me to take action. Thank you so much. Yes, we are in the action business and God is in the results business. Beautiful. Now, does the feeling of your childhood of not enoughness come back if you don't do daily prayer and meditation, devotion, selfless service? Or is that feeling of not enoughness gone forever after that spiritual flash of enlightenment on the river?
Great question. So certain aspects gone forever.
Great.
Several aspects of that which I struggled with depression, anxiety. I had been also severely bulimic. That, by God's grace, literally disappeared within the first, I mean, almost in that moment, but literally within the first 7 days, five, 7 days. I mean, it was just
beautiful. Gone. Beautiful.
But this idea of you are better if you do and achieve and accomplish than if you don't is definitely something that every once in a while will kind of arise back, and I'll notice it. You know, 30 years has given me a beautiful foundation of anchoring in awareness. And so it's not that you stop being human, but it's that you stop being impacted and enslaved by these fluctuations of the mind. Mm-hmm. What, you know, in yogic philosophy, we talk about as the wave-like fluctuations in the mind. So it's not that the mind completely stops fluctuating. It's not that these thoughts never arise. It's that you no longer identify that with them. And so you're able to look at them, notice them, say, oh. And these days, whenever something arises, I find myself fascinated by it. So instead of being entrapped or enslaved by it, I am fascinated. I'll say, wow, that is so interesting. Like, why did that thing make me so angry? Or why did that make me upset? Or why do I suddenly find myself having this anxiety about something working or not working or succeeding or not succeeding? Like, that's so interesting. Where is this coming from out of the blue? And just being able to peel back layer after layer, because from what I've seen, the human psyche is extraordinarily interesting. And you peel back layers, and for a while, it feels like you're done. And then something else arises. And sure, you could get all upset about it and realize, oh my God, I wasn't done. But for me, it's actually just, it's exciting. It's beautiful. It's like, oh, another opportunity to peel back more layers and to go deeper and to see clearer. So yeah, the debilitating stuff, by God's grace, went away in those moments. But the more, I think, deeply embedded cultural plus personal aspects of the psyche, certainly still have, you know, vestigial elements, but they're beautiful pathways into the human psyche. So yeah, whenever they arise, I just find myself really, really interested at seeing what new aspect of myself they can show as I'm able to peel them back. And for everybody listening, one of the most powerful tools that I use and that is available for everyone is just the practice of being aware, of noticing, oh, there is this thought, there is this feeling. But first of all, simply because it exists between my two ears in my gray and white matter does not actually mean it's true.
Mm-hmm.
We have this illusion that because it exists in my brain and I hear it from inside my head, that it's basically canon, and it is true, it is spoken by God, and that is just not true at all. We take in so many projections. We take in so much indoctrination. We take in fears and desires, and there's so much that makes up that inner voice. So the first thing is just to realize, just because I'm thinking it doesn't make it true. And to really look at it for its validity. But then to realize, I'm not that thought. Yes, there is a pattern of chemical and electrical behavior happening. in my brain right now that we call anxiety, or we call depression, or we call sadness, or we call anger. But I'm not that. I'm not my dopamine. I'm not my serotonin. I'm not my norepinephrine. I'm not oxytocin. I'm not the chemicals. I'm not the electrical charge, you know, hurtling down my axon that's going to, it's not what I am. It's happening. There is electricity. There is chemistry. But I'm not that. Meaning, therefore, that I am not the emotions. I'm not the thoughts. I'm not the memories. I'm not that. And just shifting identification from I am depressed, I am miserable, I am angry, I am addicted, I am this, to I am the one who is aware. I am that power of awareness. And in this moment, I am being aware of a wave of anger that seems to be building. Or I am aware of an experience of pain that is prevalent in my solar plexus or my shoulders or my neck. But I'm not that pain. I'm the one watching it. I'm the one who's aware. And just a naming practice, you know, in Sanskrit, we say niti,
naming, just naming it, that helps abate it. And I mean, in the world that we're in, especially in the West, as you know, it's a world of chaos, noise, distraction, wars, rumors of wars, divisiveness. Do you have any, I love the naming practice, other daily practices that our listeners could do to find some peace in such a chaotic world that we're living in today?
Absolutely. And just quickly, when going back to the naming for a moment, we look at it, we name it, and then there's a critical piece. Mm-hmm. The Sanskrit of the critical piece is neti, N-E-T-I, and it means not this, not
neti, neti.
And it's simply an inner acknowledgement. I am not this. I am not the clothes I wear. I am not the skin beneath the clothes. So I'm, you know, no aspects of the body. I'm not the chemistry or electricity in the brain. I'm not someone else's projections. I am not, therefore, the thoughts or the emotions. If I'm not the body, then I'm not the history of what has happened to it. I'm not the story. I am that which is aware. I am the light of awareness shining upon an ever-changing, constantly changing experience of self. But I'm that light of awareness. And in the same way that, you know, you could take a flashlight and shine it on a doorknob, and then on a table, and then on a chair, and then on a bed. That which the light is shining on keeps changing, but the light is constant. Mm. And so anchoring as the light rather than the objects that the light is shining on. So I am anchoring in the awareness rather than the object that I am aware of. In terms of other practices, yeah, there's so many. So first of all, I think really well-planned doses, both quality and quantity, of what we take in is critical. It's like saying, I have this pervasive stomach ache. I've got awful constipation. I'm gaining weight, my cholesterol is skyrocketing, and I'm in awful shape. And well, yeah, all day long I eat pizza and ice cream and Fritos and Oreos. And you'd say, well, maybe you want to look at what you take in and the impact that it has on how you feel. Like, that would be obvious.
Yes.
And yet, when it's mental and emotional rather than physical, the link is just as strong, but we don't recognize it as quite as obviously. So we watch on TV, we stream, scroll endlessly on social media, we open up messages, WhatsApp, Messenger, whatever people use that others send us. And it's literally like, you know, somebody's tossing Oreos in your mouth and you're just going, and then you're wondering why your stomach hurts. And
yeah.
So we really need to be very careful about what we take in. You know, if you sit in a room full of cigarette smoke and you walk out and you're coughing, you're going to understand it's because you just sat in a room full of cigarette smoke, and you're going to think 10 times before going in it again. But when you walk out of a conversation or a gathering online or in person and you feel angry, you're full of rage, you're full of outrage, you're full of divisiveness, rather than taking that as a personal thing, ask yourself, like, where was I just? What did I take in energetically from around me? Because we're energetic beings. And just like we're impacted by the food we eat or the air we breathe, we're so impacted by the energy around us. And it's not just the physical energy in person, it's what we're watching, what we're listening to, the videos that we're seeing, the social media stuff that we're seeing. Because remember, the algorithms are there not to fuel peace. They're there to fuel rage and outrage. Mm-hmm. And so the more that we allow these channels to decide what we see, rather than having a proactive role of what I want to see, we just become victims of the algorithm. So that's a critical piece, like really curate well the amount that you're going to watch and exactly what you're going to watch. Like if you open my Instagram, all you're going to see are nebulas and chimpanzees. It's Jane Goodall and it's NASA.
Yes, and love it.
So I open and I am just constantly overwhelmed by the beauty and the glory of creation. Like every time I open, it's like, oh my God, another nebula, another galaxy, another solar system. Wow, this creation. Or it's, you know, Jane Goodall and her chimpanzees. So we have the ability to curate what we take in. And I think it's critical that we do it. And it's not about a spiritual bypass. It's not about denial of the hard truths. It's about a clear recognition of how much information we need, how frequently we need it, the details of what we need, based on what we can do about it. Because to make yourself sick with misery over that over which we have no control is not helpful.
True.
What we need to do is ask ourselves, where can I actually be of value? So, yes, picket, shout, sign, you know, petitions, write your Congress people to stop supporting wars around the world that we don't believe in. But don't use up all your energy doing that, because there's also starving children wherever you live in the world. And make sure that you've got enough energy left over to make some sandwiches and take them out and actually serve them to the people living on the streets in your community. People in your community are sleeping on the street without blankets. The winter is coming. Don't use all your energy screaming and yelling into a void, because social media feels like we've accomplished something, but ultimately it's like a cyber void. You put a litany online and you feel like you've had a catharsis, but it hasn't actually moved the needle in any way. But if you went out and you took blankets and you gave them to people sleeping on the streets and you fed people in the streets, or you did something that actually made a difference, A, you'd actually be making a difference, and B, you would be giving yourself an experience of agency an impact rather than a constant experience of being totally out of control and hopeless in the face of that which outrages me.
And
the last piece that I think is really important is that we not allow people to divide us into camps. You know, we all know the saying of, you know, divide and conquer, united we stand, divided we fall. And that basically the motto and mission of invaders, colonizers throughout history has been divide and conquer. I live in India. It's what, you know, from the Mughal Empire to the Britishers and everybody who's ever invaded India, it's exactly what they did. It's like, let's divide these people. Let's bring in a caste system. Let's do things to make them fight against each other. Thankfully, it didn't work too well, and there's still so much strength and culture here. But you see it in colonized populations everywhere. You see it with invaders everywhere. It's how can we divide these people? And that which is happening in our society may be being done by people who don't look like invaders. Like, they may, you know, also have American passports. But for all practical purposes, from a position of values and ethos, they're those looking to conquer us, whether it's conquer our vote, conquer our money, conquer our compliance, conquer us to just become, you know, numb and hopeless, whatever it is. They're looking to divide us in order to conquer. And it feels critical to me that we not allow ourselves to be divided, and that we remember that we live in a world in which we can agree to disagree, and where, you know, debate is something that we learn from seventh grade, and it's
exactly,
and have a position and state your position with intelligence and be quiet while the other person is stating their position. And then afterwards, regardless of who wins the debate, you go out and have lunch together.
Exactly. We can all learn from each other. If we all had the same opinion, we wouldn't have any interesting discussions at parties or at, you know, symposiums. It's like, it's okay to have a difference of opinion and to listen and to learn. I know your assistant is telling me in the back, I can feel her, oh, you know, Sadhviji has another meeting. Let's do a couple quick, fun, rapid fire questions. Chai or coffee, which you prefer?
I know this is rapid fire and it's supposed to be fast, but I have to qualify this answer.
Okay.
Chai, if the coffee is Nescafe, which tragically it is in far too many places of India, but coffee if it's actually nicely brewed filtered coffee.
Okay. Sunset or sunrise?
Both. Both. Every day.
Favorite yoga move or sutra?
So many, but I will give you one. There's a beautiful, well, okay. So I'm going to give you a beautiful one. It's actually from the Bhagavad Gita, which is the treatise on yoga. So it's a sutra and it's on yoga, but it's not Patanjali Yoga Sutras. But it's one of my favorite teachings. And it says, Yogaha Kardamasu Koshalam. And it means excellence in action is yoga. Yoga is excellence in action. And I love it because it means whatever you do, do it with that grounding, that anchoring, that the excellence is not about performance, but it's about sincerity, the inner excellence. Do it fully. Do it with compassion. Do it with love. Do it with grounding. Do it with anchor. Do it as a spiritual being. And then it's yoga, whatever it is.
I love that. That is a yoga pose that we can all do. And finally, what is your favorite affirmation or mantra to say to yourself whenever you feel any kind of stress or off kilter?
Again, I have a lot, but I will give you one that's simple and easy for everyone. And it's very simple. It's so hum. So hum. And it means I am that. Mm-hmm. I am the capital T that. I am inseparable from the universe. There is no place I end and that begins. I am that. I am one with the creator and one with the creation and one with all and one with perfection. And it pulls me immediately out of any frustration or distress or stress over any current intersection of time and space micro situation that may arise.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for your time, Sadhviji, and your wisdom and your example of living a life on purpose, of humble service. And you're just such a beautiful soul. I'm so happy that we met. And I know that my listeners are going to want to stay in touch with you, learn how they can get your books, your website, your social. How can we find you and stay in touch with you and learn more about you?
So my website and my YouTube and my Instagram is all my name, which is Sadhviji, Sadhviji. And they can buy Hollywood to the Himalayas. They can buy my new book, Come Home to Yourself, on Amazon or wherever they get books.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Sadhviji. And I really appreciate everybody going on this journey with me today, because you can live a life of alignment. You do not have to hustle and grind. Like Sadhviji was saying, we're not human doings. We're human beings. And we don't have to keep striving and struggling and hustling just to be worthy. You are enough exactly as you are. And until we meet again, keep your vibe high and magnetized. Bye, everyone. This week's podcast review is from Play Big. She says, Rebecca Whitman is an exceptional host who brings an incredible depth of wisdom, warmth, and authenticity to her listeners. Her passion for helping others achieve a balanced, beautiful, and abundant life is evident in every episode. Her dedication to empowering her audience to live their best lives is not just a theme of her podcast, but a genuine mission she lives by. It absolutely is Play Big. Thank you for recognizing that. And I want every single listener to live a balanced, beautiful, abundant life. And you can.